Hey Propagandos listeners, it's Production Alec again. For this week we have the second part of our interview with Nate Smith about Richard Dutcher, his film Brigham City, and Mormonism. Enjoy.
You should definitely listen to the flagrant ones. I think you'll like
one interesting thing I've found talking to black people in Chicago, because I love going, because of the Mormon thing, I love going into people's family trees if they know about it, is like every black person in Chicago, it's like the family's from Mississippi specifically. The like black migration, the great migration is like very specific, like Alabama to Detroit, Mississippi to Chicago, Texas to California. Like they're
interesting.
So there's like an interesting, like, I don't know. It's just like, it's like the same sort of thing where it's like the Northern European. I was like talking to my dad about how all our relatives like live like shit, eat like shit, are huge. My great grandfather was 6'5", 300 pounds, and lived to be 86, which is like unheard of. And I think it's just something to correlate it to. In the West Midlands and Upper England, there's a type of person that is just like durable. And that those guys became heavy metal singers. That's like Lemmy and like Ozzy. It's like, why doesn't that guy die? And it's like, I think there's something in like the genetics up there where you can just survive for fucking ever.
Yeah.
If your plane doesn't crash.
It's not unique. I mean, it's for Eastern Europeans, right? Migration specifically to Milwaukee or to Wisconsin, right? Like these are the places that immigrants know that they can go to and have some baseline connection to something, right? So if you're from some specific small town in Mississippi, all of you go, you know, a black migration, all of you might go to a particular neighborhood in Chicago even, right?
Yep.
Something like that.
I live in the old Swedish neighborhood of Chicago.
There you go. Yeah.
So
the Poles, I recently visited, I lived for a little bit when I was very young in Milwaukee. And the Polish neighborhood is, you know, all the old timers are all frustrated because it's the Puerto Rican neighborhood now. And it's like, baby, that's the story of America, right? It was Pole Town before and now it's not. I mean, look.
Also, you could have kept it. Y'all had to move out to the fucking suburbs. You made that choice.
Speaking about communalism and keeping a congregation is something I think that the Mormons are fighting, right? And maybe something that's extant in the text of Brigham City as a film. That film is about the effort and the tribulation of keeping a community together and opposing outside forces of maybe secularization or influences from the outside, a kind of outside corruption, right? Mm-hmm. That would seek to undo a communal space, a communal social structure that breeds a kind of paranoia, which ironically is basically universal now in American experience. It seems like everybody, I mean, especially the right, but not limited to, is deeply, deeply paranoid about either, you know, their church or their small town or their cultural affect or America, right? If they don't have any of those things, America as a structure being corrupted by either the outside world or internal actors, right? There's always a kind of foreignization aspect to these things, right? It's George Soros, it's some kind of caustic Marxist liberalism or something, right? All these conflated weird terms that basically come down to a foreign agent corrupting an internalized social structure, right? An internal social structure that would bind or protect or create good living, right? That's being eroded.
One of the reasons why I think Brigham City works on so many levels in a way that a lot of similarly regional movies do not is it is acknowledging what is a real aspect of happening in Utah, which is when the Mormons got to Utah, the way the towns were formed was not necessarily, oh, well, there's a load deposit here. There's a little bit of that. But a lot of it is we need you to be there because we need to break up the road. Because the main way that the Mormons are able to make themselves indispensable and thus unpushoutable is they control the road to California. All roads through California are going to need to go through that area.
Mountain passes, basically, right?
Yeah. Mountain passes and just, I mean, so generally what you want to do is you want to come up through Wyoming because that's fine. You don't want to go through Colorado. That's way too treacherous. Go up through Wyoming and then you want to basically just go straight down through Utah to Las Vegas if you're going to go south, or you want to get into Salt Lake and you want to go straight across the desert. The Donner Party is the year before the Mormons get to Salt Lake. And if the Mormons had been there, they would have probably wintered in Salt Lake City rather than trying to get through the pass. So it really is this thing where like geographic placement determines where these small towns go much more than like resources. So like I have a lot of friends who's like their families from the Uinta Basin. They can't grow shit up there. It's way too high. It's acidic soil. Now they're oil towns because they're under oil stuff. But they were put there because Brigham Young needed somewhere that was halfway between Salt Lake and Denver. So they're there, right? And Brigham, I think, is very obviously one of those towns. I grew up in one of those towns called Kaysville, which is in Davis County, which is actually very close to Salt Lake. But what's happening, what happens is these small towns, as the Wasatch Front grows, largely out of their like the Mormon increase of just Mormons having a lot of kids and them staying there, but also people coming in from elsewhere, you know, different people of different faiths coming in. And slowly these small towns turn into suburbs. So like Kaysville, the town that I grew up in, was a suburb by the time I was living there. But my dad, who grew up about 10 minutes south in West Bountiful on a dairy farm that you can view the Salt Lake skyline from, right? Which is now all suburbs. You used to talk about how Kaysville was like the hayseeds, you know, like it was like nothing. And now, you know, we live there and it's completely full, right? Of McMansions and stuff. And it really is those McMansions that they're building, right?
Which feature literally physically in the film, right? Yes. I mean, they're building suburban housing, the kind that, you know, Connor and I would recognize, right? As,
yeah.
And, I mean, related because it's all of America, right? Tomball, Texas, you know, our particular suburban subdivision or whatever you call them used to be down the street from a bunch of fucking horse farms, yeah. Right? And now all of that's gone, right? The road is twice as big as it used to be, and it's suburbs out for another 5 miles, right? It's just swallowed up by the...
Yeah. And so, like, there was a real dynamic of, you know, like, so my family went back in Davis County many, many years, not in Kaysville specifically, but in Davis County. So there would be kids that I'd go to high school with where my dad's like, ah, his grandpa was an asshole, right? Or like, oh, no, we don't like, you know, like, there's a lot of, like, ingrained history between the families there. But then there's also people where it's like, yeah, I don't know. Like my family's just kind of from Salt Lake. Like we just, you know, it seemed like a nice place to live, or like we're from Ogden, right? Like that, you know, or one of those big cities. Crucially, one of the cities that this isn't necessarily happening in is Brigham City, the real Brigham City, which is not the Brigham in the film.
Yes.
The pedantry, which is the favorite sport of the Utah, dictates that I need to point out two things that everybody had to point out when this movie came out with. One is they are very obviously in Utah County. I don't know, very obviously. They're in Utah County. They're filming.
Yeah, I clocked that too, actually.
You're like, that doesn't look like Box Elder County.
Is this the space off?
Like, that doesn't look like Brigham City. And like genuinely watching the film, I was like, yeah, I don't think I could have told if you didn't tell me that. Like the Brigham City looks pretty similar. Brigham City's up north. It is the closest like large town to the Golden Spike, where the Transcontinental Railroad came through. Okay. This is more, so this is... They're more in like Utah County, right? So it's like Provo is like expanding into them. An example of this is in early 1980s. A town like that is where they shot Footloose. Lehigh, Utah is where they shot Footloose. If you look now, I think the population of Lehigh, Utah is 90,000 people. They're still like the mill that is like a land shot in there, and it's surrounded by like tech campuses of like. So there really is a thing where like this like small town, which you get the sense every house that any main character lives in is old as shit, right? Like the house that Wes lives in to me looks like one that was probably built in the 1880s.
Ranch houses or bungalows, right? So you get your ranch houses on the outskirts, you get your bungalows in town.
Yep, exactly. And two things that I think are kind of like nods is your two main characters, or the two characters that you see the last name of the town, are Woodruff, Terry Woodruff, and Wes Clayton. Those are both names of very prominent first generation pioneers. Wilford Woodruff, prophet that kind of discontinued polygamy, right? That there's this idea of both of them are carrying with them in their last name this idea of long-term Utahness. William Clayton was Joseph Smith's personal secretary and then became like a very man of the West. There's like a story that they tell about him where he shot a buffalo to save a wagon train and is like a very like legendary figure. And there is a part of the movie where right before the second murder, when they still think the murderers are outside, nothing to do with us, where Wilford Brimley says, all is well. He says, all is well. You know, they're lying to themselves. And then it cuts to the church where they are singing the hymn, Come, Come, Ye Saints, which is a pioneer hymn that ends with the refrain, all is well, all is well. And that song was written by William Clayton on the on the trail. So I think there is like a connection to of like the denial of the all is well, right? Like it's a hymn that is very hopeful, but was written during like one of the darkest periods of Mormon history. And I think that there is that element. These characters are very tied to their pioneer past, including Terry, who's maybe not necessarily who he claims to be, right?
Yeah. So before we get too into the weeds, I do want to do a quick just like plot summary of this film. Brigham City, like I said earlier, like this is the movie where this is about the outside world coming to Mormon world and the dangers that occur after that. Brigham City is about, you know, the main character played by Richard Dutcher, who also wrote and directed and produced the film. As you said, Wes Clayton, he is the sheriff of the small town of Brigham City. And he's also one of 17 bishops within the Church of Latter-day Saints in Brigham City. So he's just like a cop that, you know, nothing ever happens in this teeny tiny little town. And all of a sudden,
critically, a bishop is a priest, basically, or a pastor, right?
Yeah. So the bishop is the head of the ward. Although, as you can kind of see, his responsibilities are less in preaching and more in like shepherding and being the administrator, like the president, or, you know, like of his little area. But yeah,
he has a religious and political or structural role. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think also is very key to the history of Utah, where it is the governor and the prophet were initially the same person.
So, you know, Wes is going about his day with his partner, Terry Woodruff, and they stumble across a young woman who has been murdered. Or they see a red car from the road and they go investigate and then they find a dead body. You know, long story short, another dead body is found and the town goes into a bit of paranoia chaos. It is, you know, spoilers ahead. It's revealed, like, as Nate said, Terry's not who he claims. He's actually like using a stolen identity of an actual Mormon person who he may or may not have drowned intentionally. It could be manslaughter. It could be murder. But basically, Terry stole his identity and is living as a cop in Brigham City. And he's just killing people. He's killing all kinds of people.
Killing women specifically, right?
Yeah, redheaded women.
And men as, you know.
As a way to keep killing redheaded women.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Wilford Brimley, he's awesome in this, actually.
He plays Wilford Brimley, and he's very good in the role.
Yeah.
I will say, I would not be so confident that Terry is not of the Mormon flock. I think he's just not Terry Woodruff because he is also from Snowflake, Arizona, which is a Mormon town. That is where Jeff Flake is from. It is founded by the Snow and Flake families. So I think that
if you told me that, I would have thought you made it up. There's a place called Snowflake and it's the Snows and the Flakes.
Snows and the Flakes. Yep.
Jesus.
Wow.
It's the history of the town. And you know, so I think that there's an element there because what I think is interesting about watching Wes, who I think we have to say out front is not a very good police officer.
No.
I think
he's a bad
characteristically,
sheriff.
And that's not Richard Dutcher messing up. That's not a plot hole. He is not a good police officer because he's never had to be. And because he cannot. He just sort of refuses to enter the real world, right? Like he thinks that he lives in a perfect Eden. The first thing that you see him do as a police officer is see that red car, clearly have an instinct to go to it and ignore it. And then has to come back to it the second time. When they go to investigate the body, Terry goes like he's going to get out of the car and he waves him off. Why would you do that? Why would any police officer do that? And it's because he's not a police officer, really.
I noticed that. I think that spoke to the fact that when he calls in the code for reporting a dead body, like no one really knows what he's talking about. And it's Wilford Brimley, the oldest guy in town, seemingly. He's like, oh, I know what that is. So it seems like no one in this town is prepared for what policing actually entails.
Well, and if you take in the idea of the rebrand, the Mormon rebrand that happens in the post-war period, Wilford Brimley is a lot closer to what the stereotype of a Mormon was before 1950. Wilford Brimley is Mormon, is from Utah, was a like a ranch hand, and was on the firing squad and for the state of Utah. So when they execute a prisoner, they have five guys shoot a rifle and one is blank. One of those was Wilford Brimley. After he moved to LA, he continued to travel up to Utah to fulfill that duty. And he was wrangling horses and became poker buddies with Robert Duvall. And Robert Duvall started putting him in stuff because he's like, this guy's the real deal. But he is not somebody who is a classically trained actor. It's all natural. But I think he really is pretty skilled at doing what he does, which is bring a real gravitas to it. Of course, I heard an interview last year with Richard Dutcher where Wilford Brimley did not read the script. He got paid, and about halfway through, he like looks at him and goes, is this one of them damn Mormon movies? And he goes, yeah. And he like was pissed about it because he was like, I'm better than that. I don't want to do a Mormon movie.
Well, I'm glad that he spent his time.
It's worth it. It's a fine performance too. But so the when you're talking about the encroachingness, right? The first lie or the first thing that West tells himself is, it's just someone passing through. It's not, this has nothing to do with us. Accident of timing. And then when the homecoming, the killer has stayed. So who does he look at? The outsiders, the construction workers, the people, the non-Mormons, right? That's where we need to look. Then when the third girl is taken, it suddenly becomes, all right, so maybe it's one of the weirdos in the war. Maybe it's the guy who's hiding pornography.
Still looking for outsiders, right?
He's still even within looking the for the outsiders. And then he finds that it's Terry, the person that he trusts the most, through divine revelation to some extent. He has inspiration after an act of prayer. We find out that Terry is someone who's impersonating. He's impersonating a returned missionary. He's impersonating, but also the real person at fault for all of this ultimately is Wes.
Yeah.
And that is why he refuses the sacrament in the last scene. I believe that what that has to do with is he knows that he is the one who is ultimately culpable of this, because it is his naivete that brought this sort of chaos upon the congregation. The bishop is supposed to take, fun fact, my ward did not do this and then saw this movie and was like, oh, we should be giving the sacrament to the bishop first and then everybody else. That's the rule. Oh yeah.
We need, like, fascinating.
But the everyone else refusing it is their act of forgiveness to him, I believe.
Interesting.
And then in taking it, he is able to achieve some level of self-forgiveness, because so much of this movie is about who is at fault. Mm. Whose fault is it? Are we really so different from the outside world that we demonize?
Is it a misreading that Terry also comes to work as the sheriff's deputy by way of basically Mormon relationships, that his reputation is attested to by a fellow Mormon, is therefore not questioned?
A guy in the ward. Yeah. I mean, I think that is a good reading on it, because it's the construction guy who I will just call Frank Garish, because that's the actor's name. Most famous in Utah for being in PSAs where he dressed up as a lab rat that like they had tested smoking on, where it was great. Just a great character actor. He's also in a sketch in I Think You Should Leave. He's one of the poker buddies that Paul Walter Hauser is like, no, I love my wife.
All right. Going to be rewatching that later.
Yeah. Yeah. So he comes in as one of the construction workers, but he comes in as one claiming to be a returned missionary from Snowflake. The actor Matthew A. Brown is South African and not Mormon, but I think really conveys that feeling of that like young, hotshot, young returned missionary. He's got this like very young wife who seems like maybe like 21, and they already are having their second kid. Yeah, I think you're right. He is able to ingratiate himself. He is able to be seen as different from the other construction workers through the stamp of approval that is his alleged missionary service too. Mm. I think the return missionary thing is a very important part of that. You don't get necessarily the same thing saying you're Mormon.
That's a person elevated. Yeah. Elevated by that trial, right? And in a way, I mean, look, we just got done talking about the Westerns and the elevation of the true citizen that's been molded by the experience on the frontier. And I feel like I'm hearing echoes of that in a kind of religious way, right?
When I was listening to that episode and you were like, they never bring up, you know, religion in the West. And I was like, boy, do I have a certain subset of the West for you, my friend.
By the way, that's just a mistake, right? That's just, just Costner just not caring about historiography at all. But
this is a thing, I believe it is Jan Shipps, who is a historian, talks, I think she calls it the Deseret Donut, that when she's talking about depictions of the West, often physically go into Utah, right? All those John Ford movies are shot in Utah, in Mormon territory, but they never deal with Mormonism, or they really avoid dealing with Mormons in general, I think because of the feeling of like, let's just keep it uncomplicated. Wallace Stegner, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning author who was from Utah, not LDS, has a quote that John Krakauer uses at the start of Under the Banner of Heaven, which is that Mormons, it is impossible to write fiction about Mormons because the culture is so strange that you have to constantly get involved in digressions of explanation.
Which is, I mean, again, not unique, right?
Yeah. The older I get, the more I realize that, right?
To do a real historical analysis of a thing that existed and was tremendously important, which is American religious sectarianism. You know, that grows in importance as they move west, right? Which is a vital component of events as big as the fucking Civil War, is just really not something. I think we actually have a cultural disaffect from it. We don't like to think about it, especially in grand narratives about the West, where a kind of racial cohesion of the whites against natives, you know, is present in our imagining of the Civil War as a kind of secular battle between economic forms, but really just it boils down to a moral failure that we refuse to allow a religious component in, because look, these Baptists are still fucking around, right? They're still right down the road from you. I think it's a critical failure of a kind of American reckoning, but what isn't? I mean, you know.
Well, I think there's an embarrassment. So I was thinking of this, a writer who I often like, although I think he sometimes, in defense of the LDS Church, enters into a level of disingenuousness that is common with the tropes. But McKay Coppins, who's a writer for The Atlantic, there was an article about how the Great Salt Lake is dying, right? All the water that goes into the Great Salt Lake has been diverted, both to grow crops and also to house this growing population of the Wasatch Front. It's a massive issue. And there was an article about how, who's to say how big of a part of it this is, but making the desert bloom, right? It's been a real central part, right? The plow, like your guest last week said, like the plow brings the rain.
The rain follows the plow.
The rain follows the plow, right? There's just this element of like, especially if you look in Salt Lake, where it is at odds, the settlement is at odds with the landscape in the way that Las Vegas is not. In Las Vegas, a lot of people don't have lawns. They have the gravel, or there's like a lot of like desert imagery. Now, Salt Lake is not as dry as that, but Salt Lake wants to look like Missouri. It wants to look like the places that the Mormons were kicked out of. And McKay Coppins made fun of that, like where he's like, oh, that's psychological. I'm like, dude, he's a Mormon that grew up in Boston. I'm like, you don't know shit about the actual feeling in Utah is like that we want this place to be greener. We want this place to like be the bounteous, you know, Garden of Eden.
And presumably look like the rest of America, right? I mean, you want your suburbs to look like the suburbs in a fucking movie, right? Yeah. It's why they look like that, by the way, right? You've been sold a vision. And if your life does not comport to that vision, it causes internal strife, right? Within people, within their self-conception.
Yeah. And I think I like that you locked in on this is a movie about urbanization as much as anything, or suburbanization of rural areas.
Yeah. I also want to point out that a recurring theme in this movie is the balance of, for lack of a better term, skepticism versus innocence, and like being trusting of everybody and the consequences that come of that. But also like, don't be too paranoid about people. And we get hints of that. There's the Bible study scene where they're talking about that. The balance of it. And then, you know, Stu, which is Wilford Brimley's character, he says a line that I think is fantastic, which is like, nothing attracts a serpent quite like a paradise. And we also hear from Ralph, who is the guy who runs the construction site, where he tells a story of, I used to be so trusting and I didn't run background checks on any of my employees until a young kid robbed me. And then now I do a background check on everybody. And of course, critically, he starts running background checks after he hires Terry, after he brings Terry into the Mormon fold. And so it is this, like, your skepticism is good now, but it was a day late and a dollar short.
Well, and he's telling that to Wes, and Wes is like looking at him like this is a new concept to him.
Yeah.
Right? He introduces the idea of background checks into the movie, like in real time, where Wes is just like,
well, why would you need that modern construct, right? We have a social order and a social cohesion that keeps us safe, right? Wes is continually upset about upsetting a social peace, right? It's why he doesn't announce anything about the murder. It's why he sloughs it off.
Right.
He says, this will upset people in a way that is, and I think this is actually true, right? That inclination, that this will upset the social order in a way that cannot be put back, that social trust must be protected. Right. And he does so, unfortunately, at the peril of that very structure. Right. His lying contributes to, in the end, the crisis experience, whether or not it's actually cathartically absolved in the end, or whether in a much darker sense. Right. This community could be forever broken. Right. I mean, your fucking prom queen gets murdered and put under the town gazebo. Right. Like, that's not something that this kind of community can probably come back from. But
they'll come back from, but they're changed.
Yeah, like,
they're changed. No. Yes.
Now, one thing Dutcher also does on this, like, innocence versus trust thing is he turns the mirror towards us, the audience. And something that he does really, really well is this red herring after red herring after red herring. And I felt like, oh, this guy's like a master of suspense. Like, there's a point in time where you think Ralph is the killer and he's going to kill an FBI agent who comes into town. There's a point where you think that, oh, Peg is the secretary for the police station and maybe her boyfriend is behind it. And everyone kind of seems like a suspect, and we doubt everybody. And the person who it ends up being, and maybe this is a flaw in the script, I'm not sure, I need to rewatch it, but it's the person that we least expect, because there's no clues whatsoever that Terry is the killer.
So a couple of things,
yes,
that you would see on second that I think are interesting that he leaves in there is, one, Terry is the one who wants to get involved the most in the investigation, which we know is something that the killers want to do. Particularly, he wants Wes to run the investigation because Wes is somebody who he has already successfully conned.
Wow.
And that scene in the shooting range, when I saw it when I was 11, the moment where I thought, for the first time, I thought it might be Terry, is when they're out shooting and he's like, is there anything you could do to cure this man? Because that felt to me to be a very Mormon, a feeling of Mormon guilt. There's something dark in me that I am like, I think Terry genuinely does, in his own way, like, think that this maybe is something that he can stop doing and he can just be the normal Mormon guy. I think I think the way we should read the events of the film is that seeing the woman from his past ignites a killing fury.
Yeah.
Or a killing frenzy, but that he's been able to stop those in the past too. I think one of the elements that hangs over this historically is Ted Bundy, because Ted Bundy comes to Utah because he was dating a Mormon woman in Seattle, comes to do law school at the University of Utah, gets baptized into the Mormon church, and less than a year later is arrested, right? And his young single adults ward initially is supporting him. It must be somebody else, right? Also, that it's this look of the girl. Like, Ted Bundy was specifically kidnapping girls that reminded him of his ex-girlfriend so he could work out this ritual. That you sense that probably Terry is working, because we know that he had abused a redheaded girl back in Snowflake, that it's something about this girl. I really like that we're not explained that much. I think they leave just enough for us to think about. But they don't even actually tell you what his real name was, right?
It's good. It's good writing too. When exactly that shooting scene you're reminding me, when Terry almost self-acknowledges, like, half-heartedly, that the solution is put a bullet in this fucking guy, and he's talking about himself, right? Like,
yeah.
Potentially, you know, he's asking whether this can be cured, but he knows what the permanent answer is, right? Which is, somebody's got to put an end to this, right?
It's also very Mormon. That's the in the terminology of the old Utah, when they had to do something like that, which they did have to do a couple of times, the terminology they'd say is we send him on his way to California.
A literal geographic ascription. That's great.
So a couple of other things I wanted to point out in this film is the role that Sin plays in it. And so I pointed out that, like, Stu, Wilford Brimley, he could have lived if he just didn't go smoke a cigarette. And God even gave him a chance of, like, look, man, you don't have a lighter. You can't smoke the cigarette you just bought. And he goes back into the gas station and blammo, he gets shot. So, like, if he had only resisted.
If he had a lighter, he would have survived because he wouldn't have gone back into the station.
If he'd been a better smoker.
Yeah.
As a former smoker myself, I also caught on there. I was like, what are the prices behind her? And it was like $350.
I saw that. Like, good Lord.
I think so. You've got that. You've also got the guy who is the photographer.
Yes. He seems kind of creepy. You think maybe he has something to do with it. And it's revealed that he has a deep, dark secret, which is he has a porno collection. And when we were talking about God City, and you said, I'd rather you come back in a casket than come back dishonored. Is that the word you use?
Yeah.
Dishonored. And it seems to be like the town's like, he may not have killed someone, but he has a porno collection, and this is way worse. The fact that they bring him in and they're like, we can't charge him with anything. We can't hold him for too long. And they don't seem to care. It's just like that there's God's law, and then there's, you know, the law that we ascribe to.
I remember people at the time being like, oh, that's so unrealistic that they would go from door to door and just, have you ever heard of the Fourth Amendment, which is a very funny thing because this was released in August of 2001. So this is like right before we're about to acknowledge that the Fourth through Sixth Amendments are guidelines at best.
And now, also, I don't think these people have ever experienced the way that police operate during a crisis. All that shit, you know, you can sue me, but I'm putting cuffs on you now. Right. That's how it goes.
I wanted to point something out, and Nate, you tell me if I'm way off base here or not. But you mentioned how Terry has, like, if you can't help but think of Ted Bundy. When I watched this, the photographer, I couldn't help but think of Richard Jewell. And, you know, the Richard Jewell case happened in like 1997, and a big controversy around him was that he had a porno collection and lived with his mother. Obviously, this guy is capable of lying about a bombing at the Olympics, right?
Yeah, he's coded. When you first see him and you start getting the sense of him being creepy, it's largely because he's alone, right? You see all these people in the temple, and they're surrounded by either their spouse or their family. And then he's just solo. He's unmarried. He's single.
Yeah, which is unusual. Very unusual. And normally would put him in a different congregation. There's usually a singles ward.
Interesting.
Where you like go to hook up. There's a reason in the BYU Utah rivalry, BYU is pejoratively referred to as the zoo because it's just sending them all down there for mating purposes, like where it's like everyone's getting paired up. But there is, and probably if we were to psychoanalyze, he probably is unmarried because he has a porn addiction, and that is going to put the kibosh on him ever getting super far in a relationship, because that's going to have to come up if he's going to go through the temple.
Yeah. Right? Alec pointed out that he probably wouldn't have gotten busted with the porno collection if he didn't have a padlock, two padlocks on his closet. But
I had no chill.
Yeah. But I also thought it was weird that his mom seemingly knew about it and was just like really trying to keep the cops out of the house and was yelling at him when they entered the house. And it was just silly.
You know, his mom was not at church with him. I think there could be a read that his mom is not as active as he is. Hmm. And I mean, she has to, like, the padlock, she has to know. It felt very violating, especially now that you know that it is the killer that is holding the gun to his head and having his secret outed.
It's amazing how tense you make a moment about a padlock on a closet door. And I mean, to be honest, right? Like I talked to Connor after he watched the film, because I watched it before him, and my wife was actually sitting in the room with me. You know, maybe it's the current day. Maybe it's how much freak shit on Netflix we watch about murderers. And it was actually surprising that it was like normal porn. It's not like he has a kiddie dungeon or something like that. It's not something just wildly criminal. He's just beaten off. And it's like, that's
that such community secrecy for you, does right? he need to have about that, right? Like,
yeah,
how, you don't want your mom to find it. But
when I said earlier that I feel like this movie's like darker than Silence of the Lambs, most movies about a serial killer give you a final girl to save.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They don't like, and I think that's a way, that's true to life. They do not, the Final Girl is very much an invention of cinema. We do not often catch serial killers in such a way to save one of the victims.
It crucially makes the film so much darker. I mean, you're right. There's no silver lining. It's just, will we find the bodies to kind of pick up the pieces to put this to rest, right?
Well, and he's telling, they're acting as if Jamie is alive.
Yeah.
Right. They're saying her life may depend on it, which is good. Right. Like you shouldn't. Right. Also, a couple of years after this was the Elizabeth Smart thing where the entire community was like, oh, yeah, she's definitely dead. And then she shows up a year later, having been kidnapped by a weird Mormon fundamentalist. But I do think it's an interesting dialogue change. But when he approaches Terry, he says, where's her body? He goes into that Terry scene. And I think the scales are fully from his eyes. And also CinemaSins people. I do not think it is a mistake that he lets Terry fully clean his gun and draw on him. I think if you look at the history of Western representation in film, if not actually, you allow the man to draw on you and that gives you the clean kill. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, you trick someone into like looking like they're reaching the gun. So you can say you did it in self-defense.
Well, also, I mean, it's a continuation of his hope for some kind of cathartic relationship, right, with this person that he trusted before. He's going to force him to draw on him before he actually has the gumption to just do what he knows he's going to do anyway, right? They both know how it ends, but it has to play out because any time in that conversation where he's starts quickly assembling the gun, he's not yet at the point at which he can, you know, force the issue and take his life.
Yeah. Understanding what we can understand of Terry, he's not going anywhere. That's not the type of killer that you've got.
Nate, do you take the way they treat the photographer's pornography collection? Do you read that as like maybe the church? It's a criticism of the church's priorities.
It certainly could be read like that. I remember having a discussion with my mom about that. On like, I didn't like how cold the bishop is to him after that. I think here's another thing is that there's the type of person who has a fairly benign sin and will go to every length to keep that, go to uncomfortable lengths, right? And then there's a type of person who's very comfortable in their sins and in their darkness. In some ways, that is even easier for them to hide. When you think about the fact that Terry is literally, they must have searched Terry's house, right? They searched everybody's house. There's such ease with it, right?
Like banality is not
somebody
kind of
who needs to compartmentalize in that way. But yeah, it does seem, especially because Mormonism, and I'm sure it's the same thing in conservative evangelicalism, but it's one of the places where I see couples that would seem to be otherwise in fairly good relationships end up getting divorced over infidelity, but the infidelity is only pornography use, which to me feels like an excess of, I mean, like, especially when you consider that this is a church where polygamy has been at one point was required of leadership, right? That is that has changed the nature of monogamy to be so focused and so sexual, kind of obsessed with sexual purity. I also, you know, I think that that's also one of the things that kind of caught up with the church in the last decade. A cycle of that never addressed in this is, if any character had been gay, they also would have been hiding that just as much as the guy with the pornography.
I even thought that he was going to be coded in that way, right? When they were going to break in, it was going to be gay pornography, right? Yeah. That would have been what I expected. Dark or something very banal for like for my audience, maybe not read that way to Mormons, right? It would explain his
bachelor's that number. Would have been really a little bit more efficient because that would have immediately excused him as a suspect.
Yeah. And it also, it would have been a nice way to tie up one of his earlier lines where he developed some pictures for Wes and he says, look, you've kept my secrets, I'll keep yours. And so we see the like pornography is the secret that Wes won't keep. So like, what is the secret that he's willing to keep? Did he like,
I don't know that Wes doesn't keep the pornography. I don't know if he spreads that out. They take him in.
Yeah.
Also, if you remember this time, the Bundy of it all, Bundy, right before he was assassinated, Jesus, Nathan. Right before he was executed, blames everything where he's like, I watched porn and it made me a serial killer. And a lot of Christians and a lot of Mormons really believe that pornography and murder were completely like on the same spectrum of path, even the point where I wouldn't be surprised if at that point he made the film Richard Dutcher believed that, that he is not excused as a suspect just because we found the pornography.
I'd say that we're even returning to a social structure that believes those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, we are.
Production note, Nate, because you're of similar minds, maybe politically and culturally about America, we might have the things that I'm thinking about with this stuff lead me to believe we might have a very good, productive conversation about growing and shifting and weird conservatism, as I'd call it, this new aspect of pseudo-religious conservatism in the United States, which has taken on this kind of, I mean, now, I don't know if you're familiar with like the Olympic stuff that's going on right now. We are in like a satanic panic.
We're transing female athletes so we can be mad about them.
It's disconnected in almost every way from...
I definitely want to have that conversation with you because I do think it is the most bizarre change in Red America.
Because I don't know if I can explain it. I don't know if I have real answers as to why this is happening. It's amorphous. It's weird. I already say all the time, right? These Baptists and Pentecostals, I think to me, those are the places where that kind of paranoia comes from. Or at least that's what I recognize to be most like it in religious practice that I've been around. I don't understand them to begin with, right? And therefore, what I see is this kind of offshoot as to that return to a kind of religious fundamentalism panic I don't understand either.
I think that there is and I really can only speak to this is probably a little bit Utah specific, and Utah is by no means the epicenter of this. Although Tim Ballard, I think, is a huge figure in at least the child trafficking panic. I think that the sexual peccadilloes are a very convenient sin to fixate on if you are not gay or if you are not trans or that stuff. Talking about honesty in your dealings with your fellow men is very difficult because you might run a pyramid scheme, right? Like I think that that is why the conservative right really centers around abortion and gay rights as the two places where that's the place where we need to read the Bible 100% literally and have absolute no, because that's the place where the preacher's like, well, I'm not going to have an abortion and I am not going to sleep with a dude, hopefully. Right. Like,
you know, I recently talked, I had some Jehovah's Witnesses that used to come around and bug us while we were podcasting. They don't come anymore because I asked too many of the wrong questions. But I mean, one of the things I said, you guys are New Covenantists, aren't you? And I said, of course we are. It's good that you know that. That's that represents some, but basically all Christians are, even Catholics. And I said, well, these social aspects, so you're talking about the, you know, they basically hint at the degeneracy of the United States as a social order and our fall from grace of God. And I said, the New Covenantists, so what is the structural bearing upon which we go back to like Leviticus and Lot? Because you don't do that for other stuff, right? We're not doing that. I mean, you know, you're doing debate bro shit to them, but they don't want to talk about it, right? That's an uncomfortable question, right? Why do these rules matter? And we aren't talking about, you know, I don't know, stoning women or whatever, mixing claws and shellfish and all that other shit.
Or I would even point this out, and this is something that is I'm seeing more and more active Mormons coming along to this, which is encouraged me. Why don't we live with in common with each other?
Yeah,
that's something that was preached in the New Testament. That was attempted by the Mormons several times, both by Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. Very
real
seriously.
Physical communalism. I mean,
physical communalism. Create a library of things. You've got the money. You've got the wherewithal. Things like vacuum cleaners, blenders. Store them in your ward houses in Utah and like seriously like live in commune with each other. I think if they did that, you'd fix half of the problems, because I think the thing about Mormonism, that this is my steel manning of Mormonism as much as I can, is that it is about fraternity and sharing and community. And that is going back to Janice Shipp. She says that's one of the reasons why the Westerns don't have much stock with the Mormons, because the Western wants to be the lone man on the horse in rugged individualism. That's the opposite of Mormonism. The reason that these towns like Brigham could survive despite not really having, you know, like a cash crop to sell, is because support from the surrounding communities, right? The pass through, building out this web emanating from Salt Lake. And I think the valuable thing about Mormonism is it's kind of, we've had so many people try to like start the utopian communities, and Mormonism is kind of the one that came the closest to pulling it off.
Yeah.
In its current form, it's not currently very close to utopian. And even when it was close, but like how many people have been like, we're going to go out into the wilderness, and like it usually ends up being Jonestown.
Well, so let's talk about that, because I see a through line here. Mormonism and let's say most religious sects that come about in the United States, or I mean, the very ones that end up founding them, right? The Plymouth Colony and all this shit, right? Are fundamentally at odds with what's believed to be a corrupt structure that they are trying to get out of and create a utopia, either based on, you know, hard living, maybe of the frontier, you know, a kind of a transposition of like the Eastern yeoman on the frontier of religious practice, right? We're going to live in commune with God. We're going to read the text. We're going to live that way. And then therefore we're going to prosper and not fall into the pits of European feudalism, right? Or whatever. But also is in direct conflict with a kind of modernity and centralization. I mean, I'm a leftist, right? So I see this all through a materialist lens. It's capital, right? I mean, these fucking banks and these merchants and stuff are making us not live in communion with God and with each other, right? To do that better, we're going to escape west and we're going to start over. And the odd thing is that, I mean, modernity is, sorry, right? It's inescapable, right? And those bonds are constantly going to be torn at, right, by modernity, by a vision of modern living that individuals are going to take up, especially in a consumer landscape. When the question is, do you go to the store and buy, you know, fucking Frosted Flakes, right? Or do you eat rolled oats from your, you know, your neighbor's farm? And Frosted Flakes win, right? They keep winning, and they're probably going to win forever. So that this physical relationship that you had to the frontier, physical relationship you had when you were in these little communes in Utah or Illinois or wherever, will become a kind of metaphoric relationship that you have with that communion, a spiritual relationship that you have with the church. I mean, you know, where do Mormons fall on that scale? I don't know, but it seems like they're struggling with the same things that everybody else did. They came close because they maybe made it the furthest and they were the most staunch, and I don't know why.
But this is a Matt Chrismanism that I think was really insightful, is that the Mormonism that was set up, especially if we're talking about Nauvoo Mormonism, right? That's when they are really linking church and state, is that it is, Mormonism is not just a religion. It is a...
For the listener, Nauvoo was a settlement. I mean, it was a town in Illinois that congregated pre the exodus to Utah. After they kicked out of Missouri.
It's the first draft of Salt Lake City, basically.
Yes.
The government, after the Mormons are forcefully expelled from Missouri, it's a national scandal, right? Like, it is a thing that they have a lot of sympathy. The liberals in Illinois basically set up for them to purchase quite a bit of land right across the river from Keokuk, Iowa, down kind of in that area where there really isn't much. And they build up a pretty prosperous city in the course of about 5 years. That is where polygamy first is introduced into Mormonism.
Enormous and successful, by the way. Nauvoo, before the Exodus, is like the same size as Chicago, famously.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Enormous.
It would have. It is one of those situations where it was successful. It was running up against the issues of its own success, particularly in the Nauvoo Charter, which allowed Joseph Smith to command his own army. He's the mayor of Nauvoo. It seems like at the time of his death, this is a little bit more contested, and this is a little bit more of maybe my own like personal read on the situation. But it seems like Joseph Smith at the time of his assassination was in the process of passing on spiritual things to his brother Hiram. To be Hiram is the one who's having the revelations as the, at the time, he was his first counselor and crucially church patriarch, which is a position that ends up getting axed in the power struggle that comes after. I think that Joseph Smith's eyes were at that point on becoming president of the United States and turning the United States into a theocratic state. We know that there was something called the Council of 50, which was the secret meetings that were held towards the end of his life. We know this because the notes were kept by William Clayton and were kept secret by the church, or kept in vault unseeable by the church for many, many years. They've recently started to release this stuff. But Joseph Smith had crowned himself, or had been crowned by the Council of 50, to be like the King of America, to like create the Kingdom of God in America and subsume it. And it's interesting to think, if you could play that forward 10 years, what an antebellum period that has this sort of third way of religious fanaticism. I'm not saying it's like, if Joseph Smith hadn't died, this would have worked out. But I think there was legitimate concern, you know, and the election that he was running in was the election that Polk got elected in, which was a weird election that where there wasn't a front runner.
A weak one. Yeah,
he was technically the first presidential candidate to get assassinated, though not on a major ticket.
There you go. I didn't know that.
Yep.
I've actually read a lot about Nauvoo, and you know who my favorite person from there actually is? Padme Amidala.
There you go.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. I was like, what?
Sorry, I'm a fucking dumbass.
There's a very good book by Benjamin Park called The Kingdom of Nauvoo that is like a political thriller that it really like out. It's a history book, but like it reads like a political thriller because so much of that era is Joseph Smith negotiating personally with Stephen Douglas and like these like figures that you know, trying to navigate a national political scene, because Nauvoo crucially is when the early Mormons had started to break off, in part because of Joseph Smith's desire to perhaps step beyond the bounds of his marriage. And they are refilled by like most of my ancestors, which are these masses that are coming over from Northern England. Mm. And they're showing up in Nauvoo. That is the reason that Brigham Young was not really ordained as a successor to Joseph Smith. That is something that he takes with the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, because he was the one running the mission in England. And he basically takes all these converts with him. So there's other claimants, including Joseph Smith's son. And by far the biggest one is the one that controlled the missionary effort.
The parallels to Islam are so funny.
It's great, isn't it?
It's really funny.
There's a really good play called Disgraced by Ayad Akhtar that is largely just about sort of like navigating Muslim identity in the United States and these complicated feelings. But there's an annoying character that on Broadway was originally played by Josh Radnor from How I Met Your Mother. That keeps explaining things from Islam, and he keeps being like, "Oh my gosh, I was just watching something on the Mormons. This is exactly like the Mormons," which I imagine is very annoying for a Muslim.
Kind of.
I have two final questions for you, Nate. One, you watched these movies originally as a Mormon, and mm-hmm. you have rewatched them in the past week as a post-Mormon.
Whatever.
As a postman Mormon.
Short and variety fuck up.
Yeah.
Postman.
So I want to ask, how has your readings on the film changed? How impactful were they when you were growing up in the church? You know, do you still think they're good movies?
I would say of the Mormon art that I have consumed, these two are the movies that I think actually play up having left the church and gone through my anger period. I think that they strive for a level of self-awareness that Utah Mormon artists very rarely want to get to. I think Brigham City in particular, Brigham City is a movie that I would recommend to somebody even if they weren't that interested in Mormonism. Like, I think it's a good, if you wanted to be like, I think it kind of is almost developing its own form of noir. I think if you were to put a double feature with this and Under the Banner of Heaven, you see a lot of similarities, kind of in the same way that if you put like Inherent Vice with The Nice Guys and The Big Lebowski, you kind of have this like slacker noir genre. And also, I will say this, and one of the things that why I am so personally appreciative of Richard Dutcher is, in general, that is the way I think people should approach when you're making something about your community. Would that we all could have that level of self-introspection that he has, and not being afraid to show the things about your community that trouble you also, because it did prompt a lot of discussions within the Mormon community about things like, isn't it a little bit weird that the guy that got caught with the pornography seems to be sort of equally ostracized as the killer, or like, isn't the mission really hard, you know, or, you know, because the other thing I was going to say, in the past couple of years, when I was on a mission, you could have no contact with your family. other than emails once a week, and you got 2 calls a year on Mother's Day and Christmas. Wow. That was it.
Holy hell.
Also, you're never being called by your first name. You're always elder last name. Mm. So that to add into that self-inculcation, they have changed that. Now the kids can like call home once a week, which seems a lot easier. I wonder if that will sacrifice some of their success in the self-inculcation by making the mission easier. But there's a very interesting study that UNLV did about why Mormon missions the Mormon missionary effort has tapered off in a way in the past couple of years that Jehovah's Witnesses and Seventh-day Adventists have not. And a large part of it was really put on the having the kids out there and just being in the area for a small period of time. And also one thing that the God's Army does not really touch on that is sort of the dark secret of LDS missions is how numbers obsessed they are. How many lessons did you teach?
Really?
How many baptisms do you got? How many like this? You've got to report this. It goes up the chain of command. Oh, so-and-so rescheduled their baptism date. Well, you might get a call from the mission president seeing why that is, because we needed those numbers this month.
So a kind of a corporate oversight, you know.
Yes, especially as like the leadership of the church has increasingly just kind of leadership in the church is determined. Like there's like a cursus honorum where you go bishop, stake president, mission president, they go out, test. And then if you go past that, then you're an area authority, then a general authority, and then maybe you could be an apostle, right? Yeah. And then you're in the line of things.
Yeah. Cold coffee is for closers.
Down at bishop, Wes would never be bishop in reality. One, they absolutely release him when he's in a coma. No bishop is going into a coma for 8 days and waking up the bishop, especially if your wife has died. A bishop has to be married. And then the second thing is usually when they're making that decision, the first like list that they look at is who are the top 5 to 10 tithe payers in the ward. So who's paying? So that means that you're constantly selecting for wealth as you go up those levels to the point where like when I was a kid and these were apostles that were called in the '50s and sixties, there were a lot of guys who had been like, he worked for an ad agency or he was a publisher or yep. He was a high school teacher, you know, or like a, that. And now if you look at their resumes, they are all lawyers in private equity.
And with that is going to come a culture of data, statistics driven success. Mario, what do you call
KPIs?
Yeah, KPIs. Exactly. Right. So they're management types. They are goals oriented and data driven, and they're going to apply that to your practice of religious proselytization. Sounds yes. Fucking great. Sounds definitely not something that's not going to alienate people exactly the same way capitalist structures do.
I would say I baptized 25 people. I don't think any of them stayed in the church longer than a year. Like the thing is there's a huge balance back because there's not the infrastructure. The thing with Mormonism is it really only works if you can be absorbed into the infrastructure of it. And because the person bringing these people in is not their friend, but is this missionary who is going to be gone soon, unless there's a real keen handoff,
true.
A lot of these people are just going to go. Because the other thing is you have to be, this is the self-honesty thing. If you're honest with yourself as a Mormon church, what do I add? It's community. It's that power. It is not, I heard the Book of Mormon and it made the most sense that anything has ever made to me. And I had an intellectual conversion to the church. And that doesn't happen. The extent it happens, it's very rare. And you're not going to, a 19-year-old is not going to bring that on.
Nate, I'm going to be honest. I don't think that ever happens with any religion.
That's true. That is the thing. That's always the, am I criticizing Mormonism or is this just actually kind of an inherent issue with all of them?
If you listen to the message, I'm thinking of our friend Khalid, right? Walid Khalid, who's like, oh, these guys are serious and they could win some fucking wars. And I could lead them and that's going to lead me to be successful. So I'm saying the words, right? And he goes on to do great, wonderful things. And, you know, but he is very clearly about the outcomes that he sees. Other religious conversions are, you know.
Well, how much – Islam's so interesting because I'm not as studied in it, but it very much is a system sweeping thing, yeah. Right? Like it's the thing where it's the system is really what spreads much more so than – at least as I understand people reading the Quran and being – I'm sure that happens to a level, but it seems like a lot of it is the Muslims come in, they set up their system, and then over the years just everyone kind of shakes
everything
out.
Goes together. Wow. Success breeds success, right? You, yeah. These guys show up, they fucking, you know, they throw the Persians out and you're like, damn, they've got their shit together. These nobodies, they got something, right? And then they install a structure, which is merchant oriented and works, right, to better your material conditions. And then eventually there's also, anyway, I don't want to need to talk about it as long, but eventually there's real actual tangible benefits, right, to paying the jizya versus alms, internal structural stuff for Muslims, right? You probably know this. Common misconception, conversion by the sword is way later, way fucking later.
Yeah.
At
yeah.
first, they don't even let non-Arabs convert. They're like, this is our shit, dude. This is our God. You, whatever you guys were doing over here, you're going to pay taxes because you're not doing our thing. You can't read Arabic. What are you going to use the Quran for, dumbass? You can't read.
Interesting.
You don't speak our language, you know? Anyway.
I do want to say, before I jump up, so when Connor first approached me about this, I did specifically say, I want to try to spread out beyond the Mormonism thing and do something. And then Connor found out about Richard Dutcher and was like, no, that's what we're doing. We need to. I would like a chance to come back and talk about some secular propaganda.
Of course, yeah, of course, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, you're a good. One more thing, Connor. It's pretty quick.
Yeah,
Richard Dutcher himself. I mean, it's interesting that you've brought us this guy, right? Who I probably would have never heard of otherwise.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I think we agree, right? God's Army is cute in a kind of '90s way. It feels like a '90s movie. It's actually educational about Mormon stuff. Brigham City is a pretty good movie. The quality approaches that of a good TV movie. The writing really elevates it for me, and the themes really elevate it. And one of the interesting things is maybe he didn't intend it to be this way, but Brigham City transcends Mormonism, right? You want to transcend Mormonism. This text does. Outside of some of the cultural stuff, you know, the calling them bishops or whatever, right? Like they're Mormon themes for sure. You change a couple words and this could be any town in the West. Right.
Yes.
There are Mormon themes. There are Mormon particularities about it. But this is totally representative of the kind of universal paranoia that Americans feel about just about everything. Right. That we talked about before. And it seems like that's part of what makes Dutcher eventually leave the church. Or at least that I've read, you know, on Wikipedia and whatever, you know, Google finds me, is that he wanted to branch out of that. And you know, funny because we've talked about Angel Studios so much. His gripe is these fucking cookie cutter bullshit, you know, make a buck, sell a product kind of movies that Mormonism's churning out. I don't know. Do you think that I'm onto something with this? I mean, is that a spiritual frustration enough to where it causes him to leave the church?
I think absolutely. I mean, like, I think he has said one of the reasons that there's the stuff in God's Army and Brigham City there, or well, Brigham City doesn't really deal with like anti-Mormon stuff, but God's Army definitely does with the anti-arguments, is because he was wrestling with those. He was troubled by the fact that there are horses in the Book of Mormon and that all this stuff. But I do think seeing, and this is a tough thing, and I don't want to like come off too harsh on this if anyone's listening from Utah, but there is a thing where sometimes you just get struck by the venality of the mainstream culture, where you see someone like a Tim Ballard rise up the ranks that's so obviously a con man and so obviously and is spewing sort of this version of things. And you know, probably seeing how Mormons reacted to him challenging them with these movies. There was palpable anger at God's Army 2 in the community. I did not see it. My parents would not go see it. There was anger that this would be depicted, even though a missionary having sex with a girl and having to go home is something that I would posit happens at least once a year in every single mission. Hmm. That I could tell you the names of the guys in my mission that happened with, but it's just a thing that's not spoken of. And I think that Mormonism, it was worse off for losing Richard Dutcher as a voice to call attention to these things, because if you cannot do that, you cannot better your community.
You can't address the crises of the day, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look, you're in good company. This elevation of fucking Mark Wahlberg in the Catholic faith is just aggravating as shit. I mean, God, just don't. But like, look, it's happening everywhere. This is what happens.
Do you think
he's
secretly set a vacantist because Catholicism is totally brought by Mel Gibson and his friendship.
There's no doubt. I mean, that is a real undercurrent of again, the Catholic version of that kind of American panic that's going on now. Because Connor and I have talked a lot about this, and it's caused me to reconsider somewhat. Because Rachel's saying her Facebook's full of this shit, this fucking satanic stuff about the Olympics. And when I go to church, when I talk to the Catholics that I know, I say, this is the normal religion. These are the normal conservatives. And she goes like, dude, you don't know what happens behind closed doors, right? You don't know what the actual ethos of anybody in any sect of the movement or the religion is.
At the risk of getting us down an entirely rabbit hole, but I think we should continue this just for the sake of us. One of the things with Mormonism, because it was so compartmentalized, right? That if you've seen Under the Banner of Heaven, that is about a movement in the 70s and 80s where people were doing private Book of Mormon and Bible studies in their homes and creating sort of subcults of Mormonism inside of it that ultimately kind of inevitably going through all these like hidden texts and stuff. And the way the church dealt with that is like they cracked down hard on homestead.
Scorched earth.
By the time I was alive, that was not a thing. They had completely burned out, which is smart because I think that led to like a lower body count. Because like Mormonism, radical Mormonism is going to be violent, just inherently. But the aspect of that is I think Mormons are constantly shocked when they find out that how many other Mormons believe things. I think like the White Horse prophecy is the ultimate example where you will talk to Mormons who will be like, that's a fringe thing. Nobody believes that there's a secret Mormon president. And I was like, dude, I bet you if I went into your ward and said, raise of hands, who believes this, I would get at least 40%. Probably more.
That's
wild. It's flattering. The issue with that is you're not allowed to talk about White Horse at church. That's not on the mission stuff. If people start talking about that, they change the subject. That is what they call deep doctrine, and you're encouraged to stay out of deep doctrine at church.
Is this, I guess, a parallel for this, like Xenu in fucking Scientology? It's like this is deep, deep shit, and it makes it sound fucking crazy if we talk about it.
I mean, basically, that's a lot of it, it's on its way out. A lot of it is really tied to the ancestors of Hiram Smith that come down up until M. Russell Ballard, who's the apostle that was tied to Tim Ballard, that was his, who was a descendant of Hiram Smith. This is the first time in church history that none of the apostles are the descendant of a previous apostle since the original. But so like through the Smith line, that's where like a lot of the weirdest Mormon stuff comes, like that, like God actually had sex with Mary to make Jesus, or like that Jesus was married to, had three wives, Mary, Martha, and Mary Magdalene. And that Adam is God, that God came down in the body as Adam. That's Brigham Young's main contribution to Mormon theology, and that's something they're writing from. There's all of that kind of stuff, and that is stuff that like the correlation kind of exists to keep that in quiet one-on-one conversations, not in a teaching format. It's very much like you'd be like out on a camp out, and that's where you discover that like Brother Harris believes some pretty strong things, or you know, like,
yeah, it's going out on the hunting trip and somebody just drops the N-word and you're like, oh, oh, okay.
Except for it's the I think polygamy would probably, it's the P word. It's the when they start expressing thoughts on polygamy or something.
Which I have something to ask you about this, Nate. I've seen on TikTok there's a growing amount of videos of like Mormon swingers.
Yeah.
So it's not polygamy. Swinging's not polygamy. What is the reason for Mormon swinging now? Are they living in sin?
There's several aspects to it. I think one is a lot of couples get married very young, and that's their first sexual partner. And then if they get older and kind of like leave the church, they realize that they kind of lock themselves into a sexuality that they maybe want to experience more. The more and more I kind of look at this, the more and more I think that just like people like to have sex.
Yeah.
And they will find the way around it. And one thing with like, if you're in church all the time, you're constantly talking about sex because you're talking about you're not have sex, which makes you want to have sex more. So there's some of that. And, you know, like there's like historical, you've got family history in swinging if you're Mormon.
Okay. So it's less like a new trend and more like a spotlight finally on it.
I think there has been a Mormon swinging, like sort of like mini moral panic, like every two or three decades. It's kind of similar. I do want to, if nothing else, you should know, if you hear about soaking,
Yeah, I've heard about soaking.
That's not real.
Okay.
That's a thing where Mormons like to invent moral panics of ways that Mormons are trying to get around the law of chastity. There's also one where it's like, oh, these teenagers are going down to Las Vegas and they're getting married for like the day and then they're having sex and then they're getting divorced. And it's like, that is really complicated for a teenager to pull off. But there's definitely people that believe that that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, so soaking is just one of those that in like 2009, that was like the one that people were talking about in 2009. And through the internet, that kind of broke containment.
The only parallel I have is an evangelical, especially in church camp, is anal sex. It's like where God turned the blind eye to it.
That's, I will say, in my experience, that is Mormons are the Mormon thing is just dry fucking. That's what they're all doing. Is if you've got to do it, keep your pants on. You'll have to not take the sacrament for a couple weeks, and then you take your stripes and you move on.
Okay. On that, I think we're going to have to wrap things up. Nate, do you have anything that you want to plug or anything like that before we wrap up?
No, I'll have something to plug maybe next time.
Okay. So, well, hey.
You guys are awesome, man. It's been a joy.
This was awesome. This was an incredible very conversation. Good. Alec and I will figure out if we're going to split this up or not. And as always, to our faithful listeners, if you have anything that you want to say to us, send us an email, propagandospod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @propagandospod. And remember, Excelsior, listeners, and keep your eyes on the skies. That's something that Alec and I are trying to get going.
We are not.
Okay. Successfully.